Welcome to Headlines. This week we will have Harav HaGaon, Reb Daniel Neustadt. He's the Rosh Avad Rabbanim of Detroit, Mechaber of many Sfarim, Miyune Halacha, the grandson of Rabbi Yankiv Kamenetsky's, Rod Emeth Liankiv. We will also have, we will be replaying clips of an interview we had with HaGaon Reb Moshe Heinemann, from Baltimore, who's the head of the Star K and the kosher oven, the Yomtif oven. He gave the Hechsher for it. We will be replaying clips of that interview and, you know, just adding on a little bit of commentary. Before we start, I would like to say something that's a little bit relevant to the particular week we're going through. So this week was the week, you know, of Simchas Pesach She'eva. It was also, you know, beginning of Sukkos. And there's the great Baditshava. Once he asked a question, he says, you know, it says that Sukkos is the first day towards counting of sins. Rishon l'cheshben avonos. And they say that, you know, on Yom Kippur, we were cleansed, lefnei Hashem titaru, cleansed from all our iniquities. And Sukkos, we start counting them again. And the Baditshava says, really, is that really like a nice way thing to say about Sukkos, that is the beginning of sins? And some say, I think the Mishnah Berurah brings, he says that, we're so busy in the days between Yom Kippur and Sukkos, we don't have a chance to do any Averis, so we start again on Sukkos. So Rabbi Ditch said, is that really, you know, the first day of Sukkos, the first day we start doing sins again? Like, it doesn't seem like a good title for Sukkos. So he says something beautiful, and he says that tshuva, there's two types of tshuva. There's tshuva we do with fear, and this tshuva we do because we really mended fences. We fixed the relationship. And all those things that we did to damage the relationship, when we fixed them, suddenly they became like stepping stones to creating a new, more enlightened, enhanced relationship. You know, it's almost like you got into a fight with your spouse over something that happened. And if you really made up, when you pass that place where you had that big fight, you sort of look at each other and smile. Like, you got past it. So he says, Rishon l'cheshben avonos, it's when we can look back at those sins and look at them with a smile and say, you know, we survived it. We fixed it. Now, here's something interesting. On Rosh Hashanah, the first day, we throw all our averus into the water. Tashlach. It seems a strange meaning. We throw them into the water. But here's something interesting. This last week on Simchas Pesach She'eva, what do? We're again by the water. And what are we doing? We're taking water from the Tehaim, from the depths, and bringing it back up, pouring it on the Mizbeach, on the altar, and it was a time of ceremony. And you know what we're really doing? Those very same sins that we threw away on Rosh Hashanah, we reclaim today. Because we're showing we've worked it out, we've survived them, we've improved our character, and now those sins have become stepping stones to a better you and to a better me. And many people take their worst moments and turn them into their best. And let me share with you two stories. So here's the story of Yosef Eckstein. He's a fellow who really impacted your life, your children's life, and many other people's lives who you know, and you probably never heard of him. In the early 60s, he was studying in Yerushalayim. He was a very good yeshiva bacha. He came to America, and he got married, and they had a child in 1965, and his name was Ben Sion. Oh, they were so happy. They made a bris, a pidyon haben, etc. But then they noticed the child seemed to be weak. He couldn't swallow. He started having seizures. And when he was two, he was diagnosed with that deadly, horrific disease, Tay-Sachs, which is unfortunately prevalent by many, you know, Ashkenazi Jewish heritage. He had a second child. The first child died. They had a second child, a girl, Basia. She died. At 8 months, they realized it. Their third child was healthy, and, you know, Reb Yosef and his wife, they kept, you know, trying. They had another two children who died as well. Some people it would crush. It didn't crush him. His father used to tell him, "You're a miracle child," because he was born in Budapest, and it was during the war, and their building was bombed, and miraculously he was saved from the rubble. So he sort of somehow felt inside of him that he had a purpose. And you know what that purpose was? He never wanted to see another person have to suffer with Tay-Sachs. So without any knowledge, any medical knowledge whatsoever, and with barely a dime, he started an organization called Dur Yesharim, where people would have their blood tested, and you have to be two carriers. Both parents have to be carriers to transmit it to the child. And they started where the goal was to eliminate Tay-Sachs from the entire Jewish population, the carriers. And they were substantially successful. In fact, Dur Yesharim not only checks for Tay-Sachs now, but it checks for numerous diseases that are endemic to the Ashkenazi population and Sephardi as well. So here's a person who took his very worst moment, and since then he has saved thousands of lives. They have over 2,500 couples who didn't get married because they were both carriers. Now think of that, 2,500 couples, if they each had 3 or 4 kids, that could be 10,000 lives. One person saved because rather than being crushed by adversity, he took that adversity and he used it as a stepping stone to climb to a height that most people can never ever achieve. And that's what we do when we go down to the water by Nisach HaMayim and we pull up those old sins, but now they're shining, now they're diamonds. You're listening to us on WMCA 570 or WMCA.com or on the Nachum Segal Network at NachumSegal.com. If you have any questions, you could always send them to us at questions@headlinesbook.com. Please note that 11 o'clock at night is a very late time and many of us are already sleeping. Sometimes I sound a little sleepy when we're going live. But you could also listen to us. Nachum Segal Network replays it on 11 o'clock on Monday morning on Nachum Segal. You can also go to our website, which is headlinesbook.com, where we have all prior shows as podcasts. We have the honor of having with us Harav HaGoyin Reb Daniel Neustadt. He's the Rosh of the Vad HaRabbanim of Detroit. He's the Baal Mechaba, the author of many Svarim called the Unei Halacha. He's also the grandson of the Gadol HaDoyer, Reb Yankiv Kamenetsky, and put out the Emes LeYankiv, all the Svarim related to Reb Yankiv Kamenetsky. He is the Rav of Bnei Yisrael in Detroit. And in my eyes, he's the Rav Rashi of Detroit, a great honor. Welcome, Rabbi Neustadt. So, question for you, Reb Daniel. On an off topic, 2 weeks ago, we had Reb David Cohn on the radio, and he spoke very, strongly in support of the letter that was signed by the 100 Rabbanim. He called it the Hetamei Rabbanim, about going directly to the authorities when there is raglayim ledavar, when people speak to a child or to a young adult and they feel that, the person is telling the truth, a parent, a teacher, etc. And he said, go straight to the police. And he compared it to, at the end, he said, if you see somebody breaking into your house at night, do you call a rav or do you call the police? And you're the head of the Vad HaRabbanim of Detroit, and I guess the Rav HaRashi of Detroit, in effect. Why didn't you sign the letter?
Okay, so the letter, of course, was presented to us and to many rabbanim across America. Many of which decided not to sign that letter, and this has nothing to do with the basic message of the letter. Everybody agrees. There's no discussion and there's no debate that someone who is a molester needs to be, his activities must be reported to the authorities. We, unfortunately, don't have the ability to deal with it ourselves. There's no question that such a person is considered a roidif, and yes, it's a good comparison to somebody breaking into your house, and he's a dangerous person, must be taken off the streets. Since we don't have the ability to do it ourselves, we have to come on to the legal authorities. I don't think that there's any debate about that, and everybody agrees that this is so. the question that that exists, and the reason why many Rabbanim decided not to sign that letter, goes in the side issue. And that is, had the letter, if you, I don't have the letter in front of me, but had the letter been written to the person who was molested himself, in other words, if a person who actually was molested now needs to do something about it, he wants to react, he wants to protect himself, he wants to protect the community, may he go to the authorities? No question about it. And I think everybody would have signed such a letter without any hesitation. The issue is that many times, or sometimes, even maybe a minority of times, but a significant amount of times, the information is not clear, information is murky. There is, we know for a fact that there are false allegations, and it's very easy to destroy somebody's life and somebody's whole, whatever he's been doing, with just a smear campaign, with just a false accusation, with something that's not really there. And therefore, that part of it, in other words, if we know that he's a molester, no question about it, go right to the authorities. If you know that's firsthand, if you are the victim, or maybe if you are the parent of the victim, and you're familiar exactly with the case and all the information, or somebody very close. But the way that letter was written, it was too broad. It was referring to the fact that anybody who has any information about any molestation that he's aware of or he knows of should go immediately to the authorities. To me, that could be reckless. It could be okay, but it could be dangerous, because if you're in this field, you know that there are people with agendas, there are people who are not careful, there are people who are just shoot out of their mouth, and without proper investigation and proper knowing for sure that there's something, what we would call reglaimed of, a real basis to go to the authorities, sometimes people are too too quickly, too fast, without proper yeshiva das, without really thinking about it well in advance. Or worse, sometimes they do so maliciously. We know very often, especially in cases where husbands and wives and marriages go bad, people are getting separated, people are getting divorced, they use molestation as a weapon, as a tool to hurt the other party. Nothing to do with the truth. Totally made up. I myself am aware of several such cases. Any rav in the field will attest to that. But there are sometimes, I'm not saying it's all the time, and of course not even most of the time, but sometimes that exists. And therefore, before one goes to the authorities, like any other area of halacha, this is no different than any other area of halacha. Of course, if it's an immediate emergency, the comparison, the analogy to somebody breaking down your door is misleading. Because this is not happening right now. Not happening. It's not an emergency situation that's happening on the moment. If there is an issue that needs to be addressed, the shilas that needs to be asked is not whether or not you're allowed to go to the authorities for being molested. That's not a shilas. Of course you can. The shilas that needs to be consulted with somebody a bit objective is this enough evidence? Did what I hear, is this enough to go to the authorities with, or
so, Rabbi Neustadt, let me just,
that's the question.
Let me just say, the letter reads like this: we, the undersigned, affirm that any individual with first-hand knowledge or reasonable basis to suspect child abuse. Now, it's based to, those who are opposed to this are basing it on a letter from Rebbe Yashiv, which Da Gudda promulgated, and the psak of Rebbe Yashiv is based on a Gemara that says Rebbe Leza Reb Shimon used to catch robbers on behalf of the Medina, the Gemara Bab Metzia, and the Rajba basically says, based on that Gemara, he says that if we were to follow Din Torah, he says the world would be charev if we followed it exactly to its T. And he quotes the Gemara lecharev Yerushalayim el shemidu d'deim al din Torah. They follow the exact letter of the law. So based on this, Rebbe Yashiv quotes the Rajba. So therefore, the Bez Din of every dayer has the right to be oiker or to go against the written halacha to enforce melech b'mishpat yamidar. It's to allow for the and the Beis Yosef brings it in Shin Peches. So since the Rabbi Yashiv's letter is based on, he says, the Bezdin, the Rajba, that the Bezdin of every doyer has the ability, so therefore they took the position, well, Rabbi Yashiv seems to be saying that you would have to go to Bezdin, and you wouldn't have the ability to go directly. This is...
I don't think so. I don't think that's what Rabbi Yashiv meant. I think that Rabbi Yashiv meant that, like I said, that before you go to the authorities, you need to have somebody a little bit removed from the situation, taking an objective, honest look at the evidence and saying, yes, there's enough here to go to authorities. Or, no, this seems to be fraudulent, this doesn't have any basis, this seems to be made up, this seems to be malicious, and you should not go. That's what he means.
Okay, so
I don't think anybody disagrees with the fact that it needs to happen.
Rabbi Neustadt, I accept that. I accept what you're saying. I would like, though, to ask the following question. I personally know people who were molested, and they go through. I know somebody who committed suicide because of it. A friend of one of my kids in yeshiva actually was committed suicide by it. And I know others who, post marriage, ended up becoming severe drug addicts. So, if you were to call any authority, call the OU, and say, okay, I suspect. Who do I run to? Which Bezdin do I go to ask their opinion? They'll say, well, we don't have one. We're thinking about it. We plan on making a Bezdin. I mean, if somebody was running around...
I don't think you need a Bezdin. No, but I don't think you need a Bezdin. I think you need an objective Rav and level-headed Rav who could listen to the person and advise him and tell him, yes, this is enough information to go or not to go. I don't think that you need a psak from Beis Din. I think that it's very clear that you're allowed to go to the authorities when a person is a molester. I don't think we need a Beis Din.
But my question is, why makes a Rav? So why would a Rav be more qualified than a parent or any individual to say, you know, this sounds like trouble? Like, if it's not a die-in, like, what does a Rav add to the halacha of, you know, this seems credible?
No, it just gives you an objective outside look. Sometimes when a person is close to the situation, he doesn't have the ability to gauge it correctly. It goes both ways. Sometimes you could just say, it's nothing. You know, the trend used to be when somebody complained about molestation, just be quiet, it's your fault. You know, you also could become dismissive. Or you could be overprotective. Because when you're close to the situation, you lose objectivity. You need to go to somebody who's objective.
It could be a friend, too, then, because most Rabbanim do not have experience in molestation.
It's a shayla. It is a halachic shayla like any other. It's you're right. You need to go to a Rav who has experience in this. You're right. Many Rabbanim do not.
So the question that I said is that there are, if there's a muggers running around in the neighborhood and there's a Rav someplace who knows Hilchus mugging, would you go start? Let's start looking for this Rav, or let's call the police. And if there's so much of it, and it's so dangerous,
how do you know he's running around the neighborhood? That
because
has to be established.
Somebody tell a child comes to you and he says, so and so did something. If it was a mugger, would you? That was Reb David Cohen's point. Would you start asking around, looking for a Rav who's an expert in Hilchus mugging, or do you go to the police?
You would go to the police, but again, yes, if it's your own child who went over to you, I would say that in 99% of the cases, you should go straight to the police. But the problem with this letter, didn't speak about children, it didn't specify anything, it was way too broad. There's a lot of people out there who jump to conclusions without proper investigation.
Oh, without such a doubt, I personally
anybody
know.
Licensed to do anything what they want, and that's too broad. That's all.
I personally know a case here in Muncie where it was an absurd case where, you know, Yankee Horowitz, who did a wonderful job issuing that sefer about, you know, that book about how to. So parents started reading to their children. So this 65-year-old teacher in a school here in Muncie who's been teaching for 45 years, the child comes home and says, you know, he's reading the book. My teacher hugged me. The next thing you know, the teacher's by the police. So clearly we have people who are just chassidast, right? People who, you know, Adam u'behemet, Ashi Hashem.
That's exactly my point. But a chassidast, this letter, gives a license to to anybody, like you say, a chaser das, to do whatever they want. And I think that's wrong. I think that this is like any other silent Shulchan Aruch that needs yeshiva das, it needs guidance, it needs objectivity, it needs clarity of mind. That's all. Okay. The issue is not, again, whether a molester should be reported. He should. How you define and agree that it is actually a case, you're not allowed to take such a chrys upon yourself necessarily. It's good to consult. Now, you're right. A very good friend who's knowledgeable in this area is also good. But not, it's not a question of Besdin. I agree. It's a question of objectivity, to be honest.
Okay.
That's all. This letter doesn't give you that leeway, and I think that's why I personally didn't sign it. That's all I can say. I could talk for myself.
That's listen, Rabbi Neustadt, you're the Rav Rashi of a big community, and that has very great gravitas.
Okay,
so let's go to the topic that we want to discuss with you. Ayin Hara. I know there are people, we got a lot of emails on this topic. So let's start from the beginning. Could you tell us what is an Ayin Hara? Do we really believe in such a thing? The Chazals, the Gemaras and Brachas. What is, give us a 21st century view of Ayin Hara.
Not so easily done. Okay, Ayin Hara is a very complex subject. There's a lot to talk about it. And part of the complexity is that Chazal themselves, we find that they also did not have a uniform view of exactly what Ayin Hara is and how much do we need to be careful from Ayin Hara. Is it something really dangerous, something we really should avoid, or is it something which is, people say all kinds of things and all kinds of old wives' tales, and do we need to worry about it and do we not? Well, in many, many different sources in the Gemara that the Ayin Hara is brought up, some Amoraim and some even Tanoim take it very seriously. Rav, for instance, the great Rav, took Ayin Hara very literally. He held that Ayin Hara is something which is so strong, something so potent, that it has halachic ramifications, and that a person is not allowed to do many activities that are described in the Gemara because of Ayin Hara. As a matter of fact, Rav's shita is, in the Gemara of Metzia, that almost all people, all non-natural deaths, are because of Ayin Hara. You all go to a cemetery, 99 out of 100 people died because the evil eye, so to speak, looked at them negatively, and they suffered because of that. But Shmuel, Rav's counterpart, equal in stature maybe to Rav, dismissed it. Shmuel says, "No, there's nothing to do with Ayin Hara. He didn't consider that to be a real issue. He says people die from disease, people die from all kinds of things. It has nothing to do with Ayin Hara." So we find that the great Rav and Shmuel, one of the greatest Amoraim, disagreed whether Ayin Hara is a real potent force. You find many such discussions in the Gemara where some Amoraim took it seriously and some not. I'll give you just a quick example. Everybody's familiar that when a person has a daughter before he has sons, the Gemara says, "Bas tchila simen yafel labanim." It's a good simen to have a girl before a boy. The person is why? What's so good about having a girl before a boy? So the Gemara in Bava Basra brings two explanations to this halacha. One is very practical. Oh, it's good to have an older daughter. She'll be there to help raise the sons that were born afterwards. You know, girls are certainly more helpful at home than the boys. So it's good to have a girl first. But the other explanation that the Gemara gives is, no, a person who has a girl first actually protects his future sons from Ayin Hara that people are going to say, "Oh, you have sons, you have sons. Wow, people are jealous. People want to see the success that you have by sons." So if you have a girl first, it sort of like mitigates that. It sort of like takes away from the great evil eye that people can look at you. And therefore, serves as a protection. So therefore, Bas Tchila is Simen Yafel Labanim. It actually is a good protection, Simen, like a Simen. It's a good Simen to protect you from the Ayin Hara. So these two opinions in the Gemara are actually arguing in this point. The first opinion says, that's a practical thing to have help around the house, nothing to do with Ayin Hara. The second opinion says, no, this is like sort of like something much deeper than that. It's to protect the person from the evil eye. So some in Chazal were concerned about it. Some in Chazal weren't concerned about it. Rav, as I said before, says that this is a very serious thing. For instance, the Gemara says above Metzia in the name of Rav, that a person is not allowed to stand next to his friend's field when it's full grown, right before it's ready to be harvested. Because when you look at your fellow's fields and you say to yourself, wow, what a beautiful field. Look how it's grown. Look at the wheat, how it's going to be such a great yield. You're looking at it in ayin hara. That's a negative way of looking at it. And therefore, it is halacha lemaisa, says Rav. Also, adam shiyamid ostei chaver, a person is not allowed to stand on a friend, not an enemy. You're not looking to do something bad to the person. You're looking at your friend's fields. But by looking at it like that, you're giving it a negative look, and you could destroy his crop. He could lose the yield of his wheat because you looked at it negatively. How does that work? What does that mean? So the Gemara itself doesn't tell us. The Chazanish says, a very interesting thing. Chazanish says that when you put somebody, he says, when you take a look, he says, one of the secrets of creation is, Mesoides Habria, secret of creation is, that a person can use his mind to cause things in the world of action. And a little machshava kala, a little thought, a little machshava that he has in his mind, could destroy a geshem mutzak, a solid object. And this is how he describes it. B'shor shebnei odom mispo'alim al mitzius mitzlachem. When people are amazed about a very successful thing that they see, something in mitzius, which is very successful. Ma'amidim es mitzius zuba sakana. Through their mind, which
you know, can I interrupt Rabbi Neustadt? You know, it's interesting that in quantum mechanics, there's been much research, and it's hotly debated on a scientific level whether by watching a reaction, a chemical reaction, it has an impact on the reaction on a subatomic level.
This is similar, yeah. Ma'amidim es mitzias zubasakana. Right. They can actually put something in danger
I have an email from a fellow, Mr. Lemberg, from Lakewood, New Jersey, and he asked the following question. He says, my wife believes in ayin hara, and I ask her, where is Michael Bloomberg's ayin hara, Bill Gates' ayin hara, Warren Buffett's ayin hara, and Mr. Zuckerberg of Facebook's ayin hara?
I know. First of all, I don't think applies really to goyim, because it's like
many of these I mentioned are Jewish.
Yeah, you're right. But you know, look, a person doesn't have to believe in ayin hara. I want to tell you something. If you dismiss ayin hara and say it's nothing, I don't care about it, that's not true. You're not denying one of the principles of Judaism. It's okay. In the Gemara itself, like I said before, there are Amoraim who dismissed it and says, no, it's nothing. We don't believe in that. Promotion is
he's asking a different question. He's saying, in those days when there was no media, so we could say that ayin hara really impacted people. But in a day when you have the Forbes 400, and you have a substantial amount of them are Jews, and they return there year after year after year, he's saying, isn't that proof that Shmuel is right?
I don't know. It's not proof. We don't know exactly how these things work. The Chazanish asks this one question. And after he says what I told you before, he says that even though a person has the power to hurt somebody else through his mind, he says afterwards, Hakol b'nei shamayim, it's still in the hands of Hashem, and if it's not decreed upon this person to lose his wealth or to lose his whatever it is that you are amazed about, it's not going to happen. But if it is decreed, says the Chazanish, it's going to happen through this ayin hara. You're right, we don't have the power to force Din Hashem, but if it's supposed to happen somehow, this is one of the ways, one of the shluchim, so to speak, how the Ribbono Shel Olam affects it. That's how the Chazanish explains it.
Mm-hmm. Now, does the Rambam discuss ayin hara?
The Rambam does not discuss ayin hara, and again, the Rambam is subscribing to the Shittas from Chazal that ayin hara is nothing that we should be concerned about. It never is ayin hara mentioned in the Rambam. Rambam, is known as a rationalist, and these things did not play a role by him. And you're right, the Rambam doesn't give this any credence. He follows basically the sheet of those that dismissed it. So throughout all of the literature, we find those that were pro and those that were against.
So are there practical halachas associated with Ayin Hara?
Yeah, one halach is brought down in Shulchan Aruch about giving aliyas to a father and a son
together. Yeah, we have a lot.
Or two brothers, and that's based on Ayin Hara. And actually, the Aruch HaShulchan, not like the Mishnah Berurah, the Aruch HaShulchan says, somebody who's not chayshish for it, somebody says, I don't care about Ayin Hara, I don't believe in it. You can actually give him an aliyah. The Mishnah Berurah doesn't agree. Mishnah Berurah says you should be concerned about the Ayin Hara. But the Aruch HaShulchan, you see, this is a machlokes that is throughout the generations. All the way from the beginning until today, that some are taken much more seriously than others. And, man de kapit kapdimim bade. If you're makpid about it, if you're not makpid about it, it could be it's nothing.
So
it's
somebody
not
who
something
is,
that you have to accept.
So yeah. Somebody who is makpid says, Bali Ayin Hara. So the Bali Ayin Hara is effective.
The best explanation to that is, based on what I said before in the name of the Chazon Ish, that it sounds like this. When you look at somebody who's very successful, and you say, you express the amazing, you say, wow, look how successful this person, look how beautiful they are, look how strong they are, look how many children they have, look how much money they have. By doing so, the explanation is, you actually are saying that this person is successful. You're actually saying that this person was able to put together all that money and all that wealth and all that power. You're taking away the Ribbono Shel Olam from the source of his success. You're saying, wow, look at this person. How successful is he? That's called Nituk HaShayrish. You're cutting off his roots. The root of his success is not him. People don't have any success on their own. It's like Kavodei Shemaim. It's all in the hands of Hashem. So therefore, the Ayin Hara that the Chazon Ish was talking about is, I'm looking at this as if you are successful.
Right.
By taking away the root of it, you're cutting off his nourishing source. And by that, you're actually hurting him. Because you're taking away the fact that the Ribbono Shel Olam is the one who gave you the kayach to do all that chayal and to have that loss. When the person says, B'li Ayin Hara, he's trying to say, yes, I see all your success. I am amazed at your success. But I'm not looking at it with a negative eye, meaning I'm not cutting off Hashem from the source. I'm actually understanding where all this comes from.
Right.
It's really just like saying, B'siyata D'Shmaya, or like saying,
right.
Baruch Hashem, or Haidu Hashem. It's the same thing.
In other words, the concept, Lamashal, like you have a concept of Ein HaBracha Metzuya Ela B'davar HaSamim and Ayin, or Ein HaBracha Metzuya B'davar Shabaminyan. Something that's counted does not have a blessing.
For the same reason.
Yes, because once you look at it, you say, when you look at it, you say, this is what it is. So you were identifying it as something that is detached, disparate, and basically sort of standing on its own. And at that point, it is not connected to the great source, back to the great, the beginning of all, the source of all. It's like sort of disconnecting the flower or the tree from the Mother Earth. From its roots. So when somebody looks at the field, and he looks at it, he's saying, this is what it is. It's detaching it from the source. So you're saying that when you say B'li Ayin Hara, you are saying, I respect what it is, I admire what it is, but I recognize that it is connected to something that transcends its physicality.
That's right. Okay, that's
this,
what I just said now is an idea from the Rav Shitzer in the Sefer Zera Kodesh. That's how we explain it.
Yeah, the great Rav Shitzer of.
Right.
So,
if you put the Zera Kodesh together with the Chazon Ish, you get to have a pretty good picture of Ayin Hara. You got to do that sometimes.
Right. Is there any, recently if you go through Jewish publications, you see that there are women in Bnei Brak, I'm sorry, particularly in Yerushalayim, in Mei Sharim, who pours lead in a pot and it makes eyes. I mean, Do we believe in these things, or do we say it's Maisik Shafim, it's K'maisi Eretz Mitzrayim? How would you as a Rav tell somebody who says they believe they have an Ayin Hara on them, and they want to, while they're in Eretz Yisrael, they wanted to go, and I think the lady's name is Mrs. Schmerler, and she's going to pour lead in a pot and make eyeballs. What would you as a Rav say?
I I'm asked this very often.
Rabbi Nu said, and with the credit card number after it, of course.
I am asked. I'm asked this pretty often, that this lady does come to Detroit and to Cleveland and to other cities in the Midwest, and people flock to her, and they have to give her the credit card number. I tell people like this. I don't think it's usher. I really don't think it's usher. I think the lady means Moshem Shemaim. She's a firm lady, and the most important part is she uses that money to support her children in learning. So it's a form of panasa for her. I don't think it's usher. I do think it's a waste of time. I don't think we have a source for that I'm familiar with. It's not the Messiah that we have from our G'daylim and our Rebbeim and our Tzaddikim. And we don't do these things because everything that we do is the Messiah from our Rebbeim. So I say to a person, if you're suffering in your life and you blame it on Ayin Hara and you think that this will make you feel better, go ahead. Like investing in the lottery, you know, it doesn't work most of the time. Once in a while, you never know. But I don't think it's usher. I just think it's silly. So you ought to do. There's no special usher against doing silly things.
So it's not usher, but if you think that the person may actually feel better, not unlike, you know, like a placebo, and so there's nothing wrong with it.
Nothing wrong with it, but nothing. I would never push anybody. I would never recommend it. But a person says, "Look, I have this trouble. I can't get a shidduch. I can't. You know, people never have tzaras." It's a way to help them. It's a chesed. It's a chesed with the lady. It's a chesed with the people. Sometimes actually something happens, nothing to do with this, and they blame it, and they subscribe it to it. So I don't think there's anything wrong with it.
Now, what about the red bendel? What about the red bendel that people wear? Is it mutter?
Red
does
bendel
it
is
help?
Interesting. You know, it's interesting you're asking about the red bendel because, look, it's been around for a long time, the red bendel. It happens to be, just happened to be a couple of days ago, I happened to have noticed that in the Torah it says that when Zerach and Peretz were born to Tamar, so then the young Ledis put a red bendel around his arm to show that Zer Yotzer Rishayna. So why should you do that? Why only red? So I happen to have noticed there's a Pirush of Rabbeinu Shmuel ben Chafni, who's one of the Goyim, so that dates back a long time ago, even before the Rishayna, and he says, Zer Yotzer Rishayna, Mishum Shuhu Simen Hatzala V'Yeshua. That's why she put it on Echut Shani. And it brings a source, because by Rachav, it says that when she hid the Meraglim, so she said, as Tikvas Chut Hashani Hazeh Tikshuri. So the Chut Hashani, which is red, has some kind of a symbolism of Hatzala of Yeshua. I have no idea if this is the source, and I'm not saying that it's a good thing, but something which has been around in Klal Yisrael for a long time, it's hard for us to just to say it's a stupidity. We don't really find a real source for it, but it's been around. So if somebody wants to do it, again, I don't recommend it. I don't think it's usher. I do, however, think that it's usher to carry it in a Rosh Hashanah deraisa. I don't think it's a tachshit, and I don't think it's a malbush. So on Shabbos, I would recommend not to wear it. But if somebody wants to wear it, you can't last, and you can't totally machavek anything which has been around for a long time. It may have had a good source at one time or another. Who knows?
So the red bendel has been around for a long time, and you have a makoyer from Rachav, whereas the pot and the lead, you say we don't know of a makoyer for. So
no,
if somebody does feel that they have they held like Rav and they do believe they have an Ayin Hara, what would you tell that person who is, you know, beleaguered and, you know, fatzarit about an Ayin Hara?
I would tell her to be mischazik. First of all, I would tell her to not show off whatever good things that she has in her life. Keep it hidden. Don't write on your license plate that you have 10 children. Don't be showy. Don't make that extra special kiddush that's there just to gouge other people's eyes and to show that you are wealthier and greater than them. Don't do anything which you stand out. Ayin Hara is about standing out. Be discreet. Be besech ameich. Be a regular person. Nobody should look at you as if you're something special. Don't make people become amazed of you. Because when people become amazed of you and they don't say B'li Ayin Hara and they don't connect your success and wealth to Hashem, you're putting yourself in danger. It's all about...
And what about somebody who feels they already have an Ayin Hara on them? What would you tell them? Is there a tefillah? Is there a tefillah? Is there a tzaddik? Like, what would you tell them to do?
Stalker. Stalker is the one thing that works against the Ayin Hara, because then you're using that success, that wealth, and that resources that Hashem gave you for good purpose. And stalker doesn't have to be in public. You don't have to be a guest of honor. Just discreetly help people, sick people, poor people, Talmidei Chachamim, use whatever you have in order to this. And the best advice that I can give people, don't wallow in that. Don't think about that. That's not the real issue. The real issue is your connection to Hashem. Don't blame things. You know, sometimes Ayin Hara is sort of like the easy way out. Instead of doing tshuva, instead of learning more and doing tzedakah more and doing what you have to do more, you blame outside sources. Stick to the basics. Stick to the Shulchan Aruch. Do what you have to do and let the Ribbono Shel Olam take care of his end. We just know what we have to do. We don't have to dig into mistaris. It's not our area of our Messiah. It's not Uvita.
Well, thank you very much. We have with us, we had the honor of having Harava Goyen, Reb Daniel Neustadt, the head of the Vada Rabbanim of Detroit, really, in my is the Rava Rashi of Detroit, giving common sense and really Das Torah on how to deal with Ayin Hara. Thank you so much, Rabbi Neustadt. Thank you for coming.
Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Bye. So I would like to replay portions of an interview that we had with Harava Goyen, Reb Moshe Heinemann. He's the Pesach who heads the Agudas Yisrael of Baltimore. He's the rabbinical supervisor of Star K. He's a Talmud of the Beis Medrash Gevoya and Rebaron Kotler, and has his smicha from Moshe Feinstein. And he was speaking about the quote-unquote kosher oven, which is for Yomtif, and it is an oven that is specifically manufactured under his hechsher, where you can change the temperature on Yomtif, even though it's electronic. And the way it works is you type the new temperature into a keypad, but there is no screen that shows what is occurring. And then a few minutes later, after a hefsek of a minute or two, so it's not immediate, but it's sort of subsequent, it's a grumma. And since it's a grumma, he says it's mutter to do it on Yomtif. And he's going to explain it as such. Basically, the concept is that there's halacha that when two letters in the Sefer Torah that are touching are pasul. But what's the halacha if they're touching, but if you take out like a high-powered magnifying glass, you can look at them and you see that they're not touching. So it's do you look at the eye? Is it what the eye sees, or is it what is actually occurring? So the Bach and the Magen Avraham and Archaim Siman Lamed Beis, if you'd Gimel Paskin, and this is the basis. He says, if there's a hole in the cloth, right, it's a problem. If you cannot see that there's a hole, and the only way you could check that there's a hole is by actually picking up the parchment to the sunlight, and under the powerful sunlight, you could see where it's peeping through. That does not count. You do not hold it up to sunlight, even though the Taz argues. But that seems to be normative halacha. So based on this, the Mishneh Berurah, as well as the Aruch HaShulchan, say it has to be what you can perceive with your eye. If you need a magnifying glass, that does not count. But the Torah says, what looks to you like a letter? That is a letter. So if they look like one letter, the two letters combined, it's not good. If they look like two separate letters, that's what counts. Magnifying glasses don't count. And where do you have a similar concept? You have a similar concept by bugs. We know that bugs are not kosher. We're not supposed to ingest them. So the Chayadim and the Binas Adam in Sivkat Lamed Aled and Aruch HaShulchan and Sivkat Lamed Vav and Regras Moshe and Chelik Besim and Kuf Mem Vav brings from the great Reb Chaim Abrisk that something that is only apparent through a microscope is not called a creature. When the Torah says do not ingest a creature, it's talking about a creature that you could see with your eye. A creature that you could not see with your eye is not considered a creature, and therefore you can ingest it. And for example, anybody who has allergies, such as I do, and most of my listeners hear me now and then coughing, know that you know the concept of dust mites is under a microscope on your pillow. There are trillions of these horrible-looking little monsters with multiple legs, I mean numerous, and all kinds of strange, you know, horns and outlets on them, etc. But they don't count. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to sleep at night because they're crawling into your mouth and your nose. But Reb Chaim says that does not count because what you see under a microscope is not the creature that the Torah assert. And we're going to hear Rabbi Heidemann say this, and that's why he's going to be matir his kosher oven. So let's go back to the tape.
Well, we look at it the way that it seems to us. We don't look at what actually is happening. That's not important. If you have two letters in a Sefer Torah that seem to be touching, but with a magnifying glass you can see that they're not actually touching, the Sefer Torah is not kosher. On the other hand, if the two letters don't seem to be touching, and with a magnifying glass you see that they are touching, it is kosher. Because we go according to the way that it seems, the way that we can understand something with our normal five senses, which the Baruch Hu gave us.
Before, that something that's not near, you have to look at it, what's nearer l'ayin, Is that the basis of the oven, the Shabbos oven?
It is something that is, yes, in a certain way, that let me say this. The Shabbos oven, it has nothing to do with this. But there's on Yom Tov, there's an added feature, which I added into it, that you can actually change the temperature. And it works with a groma, based on the Mishnah Berurah that groma is mutar on Yom Tov. And the reason why it's not considered you're doing something right away, because really you send a message to the computer, and the computer really tells whatever should happen after 10 seconds or whenever it's going to happen. So that message, since it's not possible for a person with five senses to recognize anything has happened, is not considered you're doing anything right away. But the rest of the Sabbath mode, which is used on Yom Tov, that has nothing to do with this. You don't have to use this. You don't have to change if you don't want. But you must put it into the Sabbath mode on Yom Tov, because otherwise you can't use it. So when you open the door, the light will go on. When you close it, the light will go off. There's going to be different readouts when you open up the oven or you close the oven. And there are other problems over here, which it must be in the Sabbath mode on Yom Tov in order to be able to use it. If you want to use this feature, fine. Don't want to use it, so that's also fine.
So, Rabbi Heineman, would it be fair? What would be the halacha if somebody would want to type on their computer on Yom Tov, if their screen was off, and the typing would only be would not be seen until after Yom Tov? Would that be mutter?
It might be considered, Tikkun Mona, it might be considered that you've made something now that can be used at a later date. But let me tell you something which I believe is very similar, and I spoke, and that is with the water meters. We have water meters in Baltimore. They put in new meters that they don't have to get someone to check the meters, but the meter sends a signal. There's a digital display, and it sends a signal to the central system computer, and then when they want to send you a bill, it will automatically print out your bill. If there's a problem, they can bring up the numbers you've used on their computer, because it's all in the memory. And so this is a big problem for Shabbos. So we were able to get an agreement with the city that these digital water meters will not have a display. They have no display. But they said that they need a display. So we say, well, let's make a cover over the display. Why they need a display? They need a display because in case there's a problem with it, they have to be able to check out if it's working, if it's not working. So I said, make a cover over the display. The display will not show, but when you open the cover, it will show. So they said, well, when it's closed, you can't see it. Anyway, I said, that doesn't help us. If it's there, we can't use the water. But they should not show anything. When you open up, it'll show a display. So they said they got water 500,000 meters, so it doesn't really make any difference, and they had no problem to change that. Okay, but there was still a problem that they're sending a message to the computer. So I went to Chaim Kanievsky and asked him what he thinks about, if he thinks that's a problem. Because according to what I had just mentioned before, I didn't think it was a problem because you can't see anything, and you can't feel anything, you can't smell anything, you can't taste anything, so there's nothing that we can notice with our five senses. So I thought it was no problem. So I asked Chaim Kanievsky. He said, "It's a problem." He said, he doesn't see any problem with this.
Isn't there a different issue that is, L'chayra, the ksav that's on the meter is ksav she'ein miskayim, which would be a malacha drabanan.
Yes,
right?
It would be. It actually is miskayim. I don't. The only reason why it's not Niskayam is because you keep on using the water. But if you were
right, so it keeps changing. So, well, but it's also it's electric.
It's like
well, do you consider ksav on a computer screen Niskayam?
On the digital water meters, it is Niskayam.
So if ksav on a computer is Niskayam, if I shut off my computer on my old Ivermeichik,
I'm sorry.
If ksav on a computer is considered Niskayam on a screen, if I change my screen on my Ivermeichik, if Hashem's name is on the screen, would I be a Meichik?
If it's considered Ksiva, it will be considered Meichik. That's what I believe.
So any time I write on my computer, I can't change the page? The screen has to stay there forever?
Okay, so there's Rav Shlomo Zalman has a svara to say that the writing on a screen is not really considered writing. It's just like an image. He says, what happens if you have the name of the Baal Shem written backwards, and then you stand in front of a mirror and you see it forwards? So you're going to stand in front of the mirror for the rest of your life? He says, no, it's just an image. It's not a writing. It's not considered writing. Now, there was, according to that, we know, I don't think we have any problem to begin with. But it's a swara, you know, someone wants to rely on him, can rely on him. But we don't want to do that. So, but I just want to finish what happened with Rav Chaim Kanievsky. He said, he doesn't see any problem with it. So I said, he said, you're just sending a message. When one person talks to another person, he's also sending a message. So I said, well, this is an electronic message. It's not, he said, I don't see any.
So to sum it up, Rabbi Heinemann, who came up with the idea of the kosher Yom Tov oven, it's based on you can adjust controls because even though you're doing an electronic adjustment, it's not nira la'ayin. And he compares this to two letters in a Sefer Torah. He says whether they are touching or not has to do with what the eye can discern, not with a microscope or a magnifying glass. And the same thing, bugs in water. A bug that's considered a bug that is an Isra Achilon that you can't ingest is something what's near a lion. So he says, therefore, an electronic command that you cannot discern is as if it doesn't happen. Now, interestingly, I saw, I believe it was from Rabbi Mordechai Willey, he wanted to say that DNA would not have a halachic significance because you can't see the DNA. Now, the other side of this argument is to say that when does it count our ability to discern something that is contingent on vision? So, for example, letters, what is a letter? What isn't a letter is what reads as a letter. A bug that you could eat or that you can't eat is what is considered a bug? What do we view as a bug? But a malacha on Shabbos that we can see, is the outcome of the malacha have to be seen? I mean, when we make cheese, I guess, is the cheese inside the machine, inside deep in the vat, is it because we see it changing? Are malachas contingent on re'iyah? That is a chiddush that he is saying to compare, or Rabbi Willig extends it to DNA. I mean, when we identify a body based on DNA, do we have to see with our eyes the DNA to be able to say that this is that body? I mean, is that comparative to a Sefer Torah? And then he compares that to, he says, for the same reason, he says, when you have a water meter, if you cannot see the changing of the water on the dial, if you cannot read the screen because it's covered, he said it would be mutter. And Rabbi Miller of Toronto takes exception with this. I mean, and for example, I don't know if he says this, but could somebody do an Aveira if it's in a dark room where you can't see it? And that's the opinion of the Rav HaGoyin, Rav Moshe Heinemann, and he's, Musmuch of Rav Moshe Feinstein, and Rav of Baltimore, and many, hundreds of thousands of people depend on his psak. I just wanted to sort of bring it out in a clear, was out of a longer interview, so we took out just this point. So let's close out with a little thought on, every day we take the Dalad Minim, the four species, and we shake them, we make the bracha. And here's a thought. Sukkot is the time of thanks. Vasaftaltech Pesach, we take in, it's the time of the harvest. And what do we harvest? We harvest four different types of blessings. We harvest the fruit, the rich, beautiful, it has a tam, it has a reach, the citron, the king of a fruit, it's delicious, it has a beautiful odor, it's the father of all citrus fruits. Everybody understands what a fruit is, the blessing of a fruit. The lulav is a little more difficult. What's the blessing of the lulav? But when you think of it, the lulav is the palm tree that gives dates. It takes a long time to grow. Sometimes, you know, ke'erez balvanon yiske, it could take 30 years before a tree dates. But you know it's coming. And there are blessings in our lives. You send a kid to yeshiva, to school. It could take years before they become what we want them to be, or what we could, from what we could of ourselves want to be. And we have no fruit, but we know the fruit slowly, 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 the degree, the shear, the rosh yeshiva. It's coming, and when that we understand in our heart, we see them prospering, and we're thankful about that. That's a different fruit. It's not here yet, but in the future. There's the hadas that has no fruit, but it has a good scent. There are things we do, they don't fruit, but something good came out of them. Maybe a new relationship, maybe something got improved, maybe we got wiser. Has no fruit, we thank for that too. And then there is the arava. Has no smell, has no fruit, it's barren. It's the things that really went wrong. It's the barren harvest. And that's part of the bundle that we give blessing for. That's, we take that together with the lulav. And what is the message there? That so often, the barren thing also has a blessing. We just don't know it. And those are the things we... And that's the story of our fellow Yosef Eckstein of Dar Yesharim. He had a barren harvest. But wait, wait, wait. From that barren harvest turned into saving 10,000 lives. The things that we think are no blessing, we may not know. They may be the greatest blessing in them. I wish you all a good Yom Tov.